WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Tekla Dennison-Miller is a woman pioneer in prison work. She's been a warden in both men's and women's prisons. Early in her career, she was the first female probation officer in Oakland County, Michigan, and among the first women in the country to manage male felons in her caseload. She was the supervisor at the first prison camp for women in Michigan. When she started working in corrections in the early 70s, Michigan, like most other states, prohibited women from working inside the security perimeters of prisons, from supervising male parolees or probationers, or even from applying for a correction officer's job in a male facility. Her goal was to run a women's prison so she could address the inequities women faced within the criminal justice system. But she also worked with men in her 20-year career. I asked her how men responded when they found out they had a female warden.
When I was in the men's prison, the male prisoners accepted me, but the men who worked in that prison setting did not. And that's where I had the most difficulty. The male prisoners knew what I think all of us, all the women administrators knew, is that women who come in who are good administrators in that setting bring about a good balance and a more humane setting. So they were happy to see me come. The men who have been socialized entirely different in our corrections system saw me as a threat to what I used to call, and I'm, forgive me for even saying this, but this is what we used to always call them, was cowboys, and a very machismo type of attitude. And they were socialized that way. I don't think they ever understood any other way until I tried to change that in the men's prison. That I was threatened by some of them.
By a staff or a prisoner?
Yes. Oh, yes. I've never been threatened by a prisoner. My life has been threatened by staff.
That's really interesting. How would the staff people threaten you?
Well, I've had one who I terminated, and that was probably one of the most frightening experiences that I ever had when I was in a prison setting. And that was a psychiatrist called me to tell me that he was seeing this officer, corrections officer, and that it happened to be a woman, by the way, and she threatened my life, and he thought very sincerely she would carry that out. So I ended up having to have an armed guard, and she was tailed by the state police. And I have had other employees who threatened my life in that respect because they didn't like what I was trying to do by making the prison a more humane setting.
Give me an example of something that you tried to do that didn't go over big with the staff.
Well, for one thing, when I went into the men's maximum security prison in Michigan, it was primarily segregated, which means they were locked down for 23 hours a day. And the majority of the population was mentally ill. So I had a very violent group of men. And in order to bring about positive behavior from them, you had to give them some kind of reward, and all they were doing was punishing rather than rewarding. And I implemented a program where, in fact, if the men could demonstrate a certain period of positive behavior, they could have a radio, their own radio, by the way, not one that we purchased. And if they continued that behavior, then they could have their televisions back. Well, of course, I was seen as this terribly coddling mother type of person rather than a true warden. And what happened was the behavior among this very volatile, violent group that was assaultive and literally hurting my staff changed. The units became quiet. There was not as many misconducts. There was not as many confrontations where my employees were being hurt. So it worked, even though the staff didn't want to admit to it. They kept telling me I was just trying to change the old ways, but they did admit it worked.
Now, I think I would assume that men seeing a woman warden for the first time would presume that you would be physically weak, easily manipulated, both emotionally and physically, that you'd be a little more of an easy touch. Did a lot of prisoners assume that?
Well, oddly enough, I don't think they did. But one of the strange things that I saw in my corrections career is that it didn't matter where you were or how long you were there. For instance, even when I was in the women's prison and was promoted from deputy to warden, for some reason I was going to be a different person and they would start the same questions or requests over again. And I always handled all inmates and staff the same. And that was with respect, I never tried to talk down to the prisoners. I always was very honest with them. And it took a very short period of time for them to realize that I couldn't be manipulated. I also did where when I came to the men's prison, and it had to do with the culture that was in that prison, the male officers treated the women staff very badly. They harassed them. They called them names. So, of course, since the prisoners saw that the employees could do this, they did that too. And they treated the women staff with great disrespect and calling them many vulgar names. And it was accepted in that culture. It was totally accepted. And I changed that, and I made it very difficult for any male staff as well as male prisoner to continue that behavior.
One of the things
I did was when I was coming in, going across one of the coveted cells in the prison, the men's prison, was the ones that were facing the center of the prison, which was the quad, because they could see everybody walking back and forth, whether it was visitors or staff or other prisoners. So it was, those were coveted cells. The windows faced that way. So then that's where most of the cat calls were taking place. They would call out those windows because the windows opened just slightly enough to have air in there. And when the prisoners did that, was my very first day on the grounds in that prison. I went into that unit and I moved the prisoner. And I made it very loud so everyone in that prison would know that unit that I would not tolerate that behavior. And he was moved into an inside cell, which meant he could not see out. And that was tremendous punishment for these men because they had nothing else to do 23 hours a day but look out the window. And it was successful. They started, in fact, when I walked into the unit, if there was any yelling, I would not talk to the prisoners. And that's another thing. They covet talking to the warden. I mean, it's so important for them to talk to the warden. And if I came in that cell and you could hear them going down the whole gallery, the warden's here, and then you could hear a pin drop because I knew I would not come in there and talk to them if there was any kind of noise at all. So they started learning a lot of that without me even any kind of punishment. It was just the way I handled the situation without fear, but with I was very firm in what I believed and how they should treat all staff, men and women, but particularly the women in that prison.
My guest is Tekla Miller, and she's the author of a new memoir called The Warden Wore Pink, about her days as a probation officer, corrections officer, and warden. Were women considered to pose less of a security threat than men?
Yes, and in fact, they still are. And I think that's why if you build a women's prison or a prison camp, the public doesn't get as upset, or if you have women public works crews on the streets, the public doesn't get as upset. And in fact, women are less of a threat than men. They tend not to escape or even try to escape. They are less assaultive. It's not to say we don't have women who are violent or who have been assaultive, but on a whole, that is less of the population than it is of the men population.
Now, you said that the most dangerous place, the worst place, was the segregation unit. Which women would be segregated?
Well, in the women's prison, unfortunately, and this is how they always do it with women, because the populations are so much smaller. The women's prison segregation housed some of our mentally ill prisoners who should not have been in that setting, our self-mutilators, and the women who were assaultive, who have maybe attacked other prisoners or who have assaulted staff. And we had women there who actually started a riot at the women's prison. We did have a small riot there, and they were housed there. The saddest part was the women who were mentally ill and had absolutely no control over their behavior, and many of them who were suicidal. So it caused a great deal of problems for staff. Staff in most prisons are not trained, custody staff are not trained to deal with the mentally ill. I mean, they come out of a custody training. So it's very hard for them to make that transition because you have to deal with the mentally ill differently, particularly when you're working in a segregation unit, when you have many, many volatile personalities and possibilities of assault, and you have a mentally ill person, you really cannot treat them the same.
What would it be like to make the rounds in the segregation unit?
In a segregation unit, well, it would be always very noisy. People yelling and screaming. I can remember, and I think it's something how I mentioned in my book, when I walked down the unit, there was a woman who had thought she had become very religious and had actually had her brains fried from using too many drugs, and were washing her feet in a toilet filled with urine and feces. I had another woman who came in off the streets, and she was sentenced to prison under the name of Jane Doe. No one ever knew who she was, for murdering a man who tried to steal $5,000 from her, which she had. She had $5,000. And we used to call her the interior decorator, because she would decorate her cell with feces and her hair, and she would cover her body in it. And we used to have to virtually go in and drag her out and clean her cell and clean her. And then we would have people who were very assaultive. The one who started our riot in our prison, she was in there, and she was a very tough woman, 6 foot something, ran every day, lifted weights, took many people to control her. And it's one of the stories in the book about one of the men I had promoted to that into that segregation unit in his first day with her. But that would be the type of people in there. So it was and then there would be mutilators. There were women, and there were a huge population of men who were self-mutilators. People don't understand that population because they're not considered mentally ill, but they go through psychotic episodes where they do horrendous things to themselves, and they kind of have like a block where they don't feel the pain, and they can actually rip their stomachs open. So the staff had to deal with a myriad of difficult situations, and none of them were ever treated, could never treat each situation the same. Could not do it.
It, from what you describe in the book, it sounds like some of the prisoners used to throw their feces at the guards.
Absolutely.
That's a terrible situation to have to work in. It must have been miserable for the guards.
Absolutely. And if they did that, then the prisoners were put on what they called a food loaf, and they had to drink from the fountain in the room. So they have no utensils or anything where they could accumulate any kind of feces. Well, they could accumulate the feces anyway. They could still throw that, but they couldn't do urine. They loved to do urine. That was one of the major things they did was throw urine. But even worse than that, employees, one of the worst things that a prisoner can do to them is spit on them. That was just like the ultimate. And I had many times where I had to discipline employees because the reflex reaction was to hit the prisoner. And sometimes you wonder, you know, what would you have done in that kind of a situation, particularly after working 8 hours a day, 12 hours a day in that kind of environment where it was just constant tension.
What did you tell the guards they should do if feces landed on them or prisoners spit on them?
Well, in fact, they're trained that they have to basically accept that. The prisoner is disciplined. They write up a misconduct for that person, and that's when they are then put on the food loaf and maybe even transferred to another room where they wouldn't have the availability of any kind of open cell, or even when they opened a food trade door, they would learn to stand back from that and make the prisoner go on the other side of the room. But the staff had to accept that, and they had to be above that and use other motives in which to punish or change that behavior of the prisoner.
My guest is Tekla Dennison-Miller. She's written a new memoir called The Warden Wore Pink. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with retired warden Tekla Dennison-Miller. Her new memoir is called The Warden Wore Pink. In men's prisons, rape is a big problem. Prisoners raping other prisoners. In women's prisons, is that an issue?
Well, it's not as much of an issue. It has happened. I've had women tend to come into prison and establish families. And maybe it's because they haven't had that on the streets, or if they did, they still want one. I mean, they'll have aunts and uncles, fathers, mothers, sisters, brothers. And many women will also become involved in a love relationship. And there are many women who are predators, just like males. And the women predators have, in fact, sexually assaulted other women. It's not as predominant as it is in men's prisons, but it does occur. What is even more amazing, I think, when the employees had a very difficult time understanding some of the other relationships, women who come from battered relationships in the street often gravitate to that same kind of relationship in a prison. And where I even had one woman who was so badly beaten by her prisoner lover, that she almost died, and she ended up apologizing to the woman who beat her for her behavior. I mean, the same type of thing that would happen to her in the street. She never learned that was not what was expected of her. So they tend to gravitate to that. But it's not as much as a problem as it is in the men's prison.
You write in the book that you knew that there were times when women were able to have sexual relationships with each other in the prison. Is this something that the guards were supposed to try to prevent? at all costs? Or I'm wondering if you ever thought that it actually could be a kind of stabilizing, normalizing thing to have a love relationship within the prison, or is that the worst thing that could happen?
I don't think it's the worst thing that could happen. I think what happens is that we set up policies, and unfortunately, our employees have to abide by those policies. And as you said, you know, it could be a stabilizing thing. I think that's why the women develop those family situations. It's more normal. It's stabilizing. It's comforting. They feel like they belong somewhere. And I think that many women who become involved in relationships, as well as men who become involved in relationships with other men or other women, is the same case, same-sex relationship, probably would not be involved in those on the streets. But we all need that physical contact. We all need to feel loved. We all need to feel that we belong. And I'm not so sure that every one of them, all of my employees, actually came down hard on it, if not some maybe turned their head every now and then. We did have some that were adamant about that kind of behavior and were very, very difficult with any even a suspected relationship between the women, and would separate them, move them to different units. Yeah, and sometimes I would not know that because there's a whole classification group that would handle that unless the prisoner came to me and mentioned that. But I don't think it's so abnormal, no.
Did you ever have a problem with male guards raping women prisoners?
Well, I there was a case while I was a warden at the women's facility where the male guard was accused of raping the prisoner, when in fact we went to court and he admitted to consensual sex. And eventually she did also. However, in the state of Michigan, it is still a felony, and for very good reason. And I strongly believe in this, because even if it is consensual, you still have an authority figure who is the officer or who at whatever position in that prison. And prisoners are afraid not to do what they are asked to do because of retaliation that could very well happen. And it's not to say we didn't have some women prisoners who are very manipulative and knew they could entice men. What I tried to do in the women's prison is when I oriented the new officers was to explain to the men and women that if they could not work in that environment, that they shouldn't think less of themselves, and that I would try to have them transfer to an environment where they were more comfortable, and that I would rather have that than having them threaten my staff, my prisoners, or even getting involved in a sexual relationship that would end their career. And many of them did not choose that, and many of them became involved and, in fact, ended their career.
You write in your memoir that women would often sneak drugs into prison by putting the drugs in any and every orifice of their body. Now, body searches can resemble rape when they're done with aggression and complete disregard for the woman who's being searched. What were your rules on body searches, and when did you think a body search was appropriate, and when appropriate, how did you tell the people on your staff the searches had to be handled?
It was very clear in Michigan for under policy. We had to have almost visual knowledge that there was, in fact, something hidden in one orifice or another on a person. And it would be at that point that if we knew that, we saw the transfer or we detected it when they came off of visits through a search. And many of them had to go through strip searches if they were high classification, but not a body cavity search. And at that point, if there was enough evidence that the body cavity search was warranted, it was then done by a medical doctor with medical staff. None of my custody staff did that. For many reasons. I mean, that you had to have somebody who understood how to enter those areas and without damaging and as you said, without sometimes taking pleasure in doing that, whether it was for sexual pleasure or abusive pleasure. So we definitely had the medical staff doing that.
A lot of the women in the prison where you were a warden had children. And I wonder what your thoughts were on what visitation for the children should be like and how much contact you wanted the women to have with their children.
I wanted children to feel as normal as they could possibly feel in that setting. And I wanted the women to keep a healthy or, in fact, maybe even to develop a healthy relationship with their children. And we developed at the women's prison the Children's Visitation Program, which was an amazing program because it was started with all volunteers. And we brought in children from all over the state, because at that time there was only one prison in Michigan, so the children were all over the state, and the prison was in Southeast Michigan. We had volunteers who drove the children to that prison so that they could have a special visit, a four-hour visit with the women, mothers, prisoners. And it was in a supervised type of visitation where there were social workers and activity specialists in there. We had toys, we had special reading programs, there was special playtime, snacks sometimes was the only food these kids probably had that day. So we really, really worked at that. And there are many, many, many wonderful programs now in the United States that throughout the women's prisons that are doing this, because they clearly understand the importance of keeping that relationship and that it is important for the health of that child. The children of the incarcerated, as I have mentioned in my book, that they are the highest risk at becoming our next criminals and suffering depression and anxiety and it being violent. So we need to pay attention to that group. And right now, there's over 100,000 of them out there under the age of 18.
Tekla Dennison-Miller has written a new memoir called The Warden Wore Pink. She'll be back with us in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with retired warden Tekla Dennison-Miller. In the course of her 20-year career in corrections, she ran both men's and women's prisons. She's written a new memoir called The Warden Wore Pink. What impact does it have on you when you're a warden and you're virtually living in prison, even though you're not a prisoner?
I think that came about even more so, the impact of that in the men's prison, because when you walk through that 500 plus population, and three-fourths of them are locked down every day, and you're looking at that whole mass of humanity that's totally wasted, some of whom you know are very bright, and if they had the right direction, the right support, they wouldn't be there. I became very depressed, and I felt almost helpless. What can I do to change this? Because it was such a sad situation. And you feel totally helpless with that population. So I think that was more difficult for me than the women's prison, because at least in the women's population, most of the population was general population, which meant that they were able to go to and from, and I was able to talk to them in normal environments. In a men's prison, I always talked to them through a plexiglass window with a little bit of mouthpiece so they could hear me. Half the time, we had to yell back and forth. So it was such an abnormal situation and very depressing.
Is there any opportunity for you to receive any type of gratitude when you're a warden? I mean, do prisoners ever thank you for the way you ran a prison? I mean, what emotionally sustains you when you're working in prison all the time, holding things together?
Well, I think there are some. I think there are success cases that do that. And I think that when you watch a woman prisoner come in, or even a man prisoner, unfortunately, as I said, in the prison I had, I couldn't see that very often, but particularly in a women's setting, because they would come in and take advantage of educational programs or vocational programs. They would parole and stay on the streets. They would get jobs and make it, and they would call you and tell you that, you know, I've been on this job 2 years, I've stayed sober for this many years, and my child is going into first grade, and those things are terribly rewarding. Watching the changes in the children and the prisoners in that children's visitation program, watching all those positive changes was immensely rewarding to me. Anything like that just gave you hope that we can turn this population around, that we can do something for these people.
You recently did a consultation at Harvard University to architectural students, I believe, on the subject of how to build a women's prison.
Yes.
What's some of the advice that you gave them based on your experience?
Well, what has happened and is still going on is that most time when women prisons are thought of, they use male prototypes or they move women into existing men's prisons. And many of the things that well, even corrections practitioners are not aware of, is that women, of course, need less security. The majority of the population is medium custody, so they don't need double fences. They don't need gun towers. They don't need a lot of concertina wiring. The other thing is that because the population is small, most states will only build one prison. So you have to be conscious of the different levels, and that means you house prisoners who are just coming into the setting, all the way up to segregation, to mentally ill, and that they have to be separated, and separated in a humane way, not just separated, even to the point of separating the pregnant women from the general population, because they have different needs. They can't work the same as the regular population. They have different dietary needs. And sometimes that is seen, that could be resented by other population, by the other population. So we have to separate them to meet their needs. So there's a lot of, where with men prisons, you often just build a prison that's specific to a specific security level, like a maximum security or a close medium custody. Women prisons are multi-level and are very challenging to build. They also, by the courts, courts are telling the states and the federal government that they don't care if the population is not large, that the states and the government, the states and federal government have to provide the same programming for women. So the space in programming buildings or educational buildings, vocational buildings, have to be quite flexible so that they can utilize them for various types of programs. And women don't need gyms. That's what they do in men's prisons. They build these huge gyms, which, of course, the men use because they play basketball a lot. Women will play basketball, but not to the crazed intent that men do. They like to play volleyball, but they don't need a huge gym. Women tend to want smaller areas. They like to be in closer, smaller groupings. So you don't need to waste your money on that. And you're better off making a small yard area where they can walk. It's a place where they can play volleyball. Women love to roller skate, so you should have a roller skating ring. Those are the kinds of things I told them, which, of course, would not be true of a men's prison. And we don't need urinals. And that's what they would do. They would put prototypes in and forget to take the urinals out. And also looking at privacy. Women have a different need for privacy than men, even though men deserve privacy as well. But when you're looking at women's bathrooms, when architects have to realize that women menstruate, and I don't think anybody wants to watch them changing their tampon, and that pregnant women have a lot of needs for privacy, and there's other issues that we have to look at when we build women's prisons. And the final thing is a place for the children to visit that's separate from the regular visiting, so that they can, I mean, children have to yell, they have to move, they want to play with games, and that has to be provided for them, particularly in a women's setting.
Tekla Miller, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Tekla Denison Miller is the author of the new memoir, The Warden Wore Pink, published by the Biddle Publishing Company.